Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, Rory Sutherland here. Sales and marketing teams, listen up. Have you got your tickets for the Alf Awards? On the 1st of May, Alf Insight will be celebrating the best sales and marketing teams in the media industry. Don't miss this hotly anticipated event and the opportunity to ditch with all your clients, peers, and key industry leaders. So check out the shortlist and secure your seat by going to www.alfawards.com. That's www.alfawards.com. Hello and welcome to On Brand with Alf and me, Rory Sutherland. Each month I'll be talking to household names as well as challenger brands about success, challenges, and future opportunities in the advertising, marketing, and media industries. But today I'm joined by a former marketer, and I think I have to say a continued marketer because you never really leave Procter & Gamble, of course. But Greg Jackson is founder and CEO of Octopus Energy, the global clean energy business that's bringing 100% green power to customers, not only in Britain, but increasingly around the world. Octopus Energy recently delivered its first annual profit since launching in 2015. Following years of rapid growth, it's certainly, I think, the largest electricity supplier. Octopus Energy now has 7.7 million customers globally, spanning 18 countries, and has recently been certified as a Which-recommended energy supplier in the UK for the seventh year running. You probably will have seen their ads. Octopus is at the forefront in renewable energy innovation. In February this year, Octopus Energy introduced Octopus Power Pack, which guarantees free charging for drivers, helping speed up the country's shift towards greener transport. Lots to talk about. So, Greg, welcome to the podcast. Just to be clear, I think that power pack idea, is the idea where the grid charges your car, but your car also feeds into the grid. Is that right? So it's effectively treating car charging as a two-way street.
That's a great example of how energy is changing. Well, essentially, there are times on the grid when electricity is really cheap, and there are times when it's really expensive. The more we can enable people to use it at the cheapest times, the cheaper power gets. Now, one thing you can do with a car battery that goes both ways is fill it up with cheap power, put some of that back on the grid when electricity is expensive, then put some more cheap power in for your driving. And so essentially you end up with free charging. But actually in doing so, you know, you're helping balance the grid. You're probably making the most of green energy. And, you kind of make energy cheaper for everyone because your car is kind of balancing the grid to stop it being so expensive.
So you could conceivably end up in a situation where by effectively selling high and buying low, your car costs nothing to run in the sense, I mean, that's probably over-optimistic, but you could certainly make money treating your battery as a kind of power reserve. Presumably the Tesla Powerwall does something similar. Does it always capable of doing something similar? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, all these kind of technologies, particularly by the way, working with things like solar panels. Like one interesting thing about solar is when it's sunny, everybody's solar panels are generating at the same time, which means there's an excess supply and the price of energy goes down, which means if you're getting paid for your solar power, you're not actually getting paid very much. But if you can put it in a battery and then dump it onto the grid later in the evening, when power prices are high, you'll get paid a lot. So, and by the way, you obviously don't need to think about this. We just automate it all and it just happens.
Because I know I come from Wales. There's this extraordinary place in Wales, I think called Lyn Trawsfynydd, if I'm right, where when they have an excess of power, they pump water from a lake up into a higher lake.
using effectively, you know, cheap surplus electricity. And then effectively, when it used to be, when it was Coronation Street and they had an ad break, they basically opened the sluices and this, you know, huge body of water would pass through these turbines. And so that was using gravity as a form of energy storage. And this is effectively doing the same thing with your car for load balancing. And weirdly about this, by the way, I think you'll know this much better than I do because you actually know about electricity. And I just tend to know about advertising. But I was saying quite a few years ago to people in the energy industry, look, you could actually hasten green transition very easily. If you have three devices in your home, washing machine, dishwasher, tumble dryer, roughly speaking, and of course heat pump, if you have a heat pump. But you have these three devices which are effectively, they're time flexible. Okay, I'm not going to watch television at 3 o'clock in the morning, just, well, I probably do anyway, but I'm not going to do that just to use more sustainable electricity. But I can put my tumble dryer on at 10 o'clock at night when it's probably either nuclear powered or powered by wind power. But it struck me that simply getting people to shift their time of consumption for those three energy-hungry devices would help. And my argument was it was a lot easier to get people to do something at a different time than to get people to stop doing it. And yet, strangely, I used to speak to electrical people about this. You know, there was some guy at an Oxford High table who'd just been involved in some massive energy project. And he looked at me as if I was completely mad. But I thought, well, look, it's quite easy to get people to make small time changes to their behavior.
Now, that's where people like you, me, and there's plenty of others from backgrounds broadly in communications, marketing, customer behavior, can be really helpful. Because when we start this company, I kept getting told people don't care about their energy supplier. They just want the lights to come on with a flick switch. By the way, I was being told that by an industry that just didn't know how to talk to customers.
No.
But today, more than 1.5 million of our customers use electricity at different times in order to be able to save money. And, you know, there are so many ways we do it. It's a bit like when you go to a supermarket and there's so many ways you can wrap up an offer, buy one, get one free, 30% extra 50 mils, 50p off. I mean, so many ways. And it turns out, you know, in the same way as someone will go into a supermarket to buy sausages, and some people, not everyone, but if they see that bacon's reduced, they'll get that instead.
Yes.
It's just like that with electricity. And what we find is that there are plenty of people, if we say to them, look, today the grid's going to be really expensive between 5pm and 7. If you do your washing after 7pm, then we'll pay you, you know, 50p, a pound, £2, whatever. It is insanely popular because finally people have got agency. Like, you know, this is a market where people have always been a victim of the decisions made by a bunch of, maybe brilliant, but a bunch of engineers who run power plants and run the grid.
Yes.
And by giving consumers agency, and look, I'll give you a really good example for me, right, which was I realized if we said to customers, tonight, National Grid is going to be firing up diesel power plants, filthy, phenomenally expensive, because you're doing your washing at 6 p.m.
Yeah.
A lot of people say, well, I'll tell you what, why don't I do my washing at a different time? Like, if we give them a choice, they'd rather have the outcome. And by the way, it's better for the planet, but it's a lot more fun. In fact, it's even more cost-effective than realized because right now, you know, the UK is, like many countries, not very good at building new infrastructure. We've seen what's happened with HS2. We see the cost escalation on nuclear power plants. And we keep hearing that we need to build all this extra grid. Now, we definitely need some extra grid. But if we use the existing stuff better by giving people signals when to shift, we won't need so much of it.
I mean, it pains me to admit this, but I think if, you know, you required, you know, a quarter of MPs to have worked at Procter & Gamble as you did, half of our problems would go away because the problems are actually psychological problems. They're not infrastructural problems. And, of course, engineers love to define things as infrastructural problems. You also have, I think, a fundamental problem caused by economics because you're an economist, weren't you, at Cambridge, which is a strange place to study economics, isn't it? It's a very unusual kind of course. But the single representative agent, I think, is a disaster in economics, which is you assume that one person who's a kind of weird composite aggregate of the population is representative of the whole, and therefore if you optimize for the average, you optimize for everybody. Now, any good marketer realizes that actually Well, I mean, as I would say, in marketing, the opposite of a good idea is another good idea. You have, you know, the Henry and you have the Dyson, and they both solve the same problem to different people in a different way.
Yeah, you only need to look at trains or planes, right? I mean, if you get on a plane, there'll be people on there, a plane to New York, there'll be people on there that have paid 190 quid for a ticket, and there'll be people on there that have paid £5,000 for a ticket, and they're all going to get to New York at exactly the same time. Now, some of them might get a bit smoother path through security, and some might get a nicer meal, and they're making that choice. They've all been given this rank of choices. Now, of course, some people might not be able to afford the £5,000 ticket, but plenty of people who can afford the £5,000 ticket don't want it.
No.
And by the way, if you didn't sell some tickets of £5,000 to those who just are very happy to pay over the odds, everybody else would be paying more because you're not getting so much revenue for the plane.
And actually, the people in economy benefit the people in business. And I always ask this question. And the reason is that economy travelers, who are typically leisure travelers, don't care about the frequency of the flights. One flight a week is fine for them. If you're a business traveler, if there isn't a daily flight, you'll choose a different airline because you don't want to be stuck in Shanghai for two extra days waiting for the Virgin flight back. And so the economy passengers provide the business passengers with the frequency they crave, and the business passengers in turn provide the economy passengers with the lower prices they crave. And so you can theoretically make business class only flights work, but only on about three city pairs, you know, where the frequency is such that you have daily flights. So it is actually a kind of symbiosis. And you can see that being possible. And I think the yield management thing is, you know, it's one of the best technologically enabled things. The effective idea, you'd call it load balancing in the energy grid, and you'd call it yield management or revenue management if you're an airline. But I think it's absolutely critical that Procter & Gamble, if I'm right, used to have this department, or there was an expert who was in charge of what was called commercial innovation. I don't know if you ever met the guy. I don't know if he may still be there. But the Procter & Gamble concept of commercial innovation is any innovation that doesn't change the product itself fundamentally, but changes the way in which it's sold, which might be an innovative price. It might be innovative distribution. It might be selling really small bottles of shampoo at airports would be one example. Amazon Prime would be another example of a really interesting pricing innovation, which effectively just changes the way people pay for the same thing. And I think because we never had a name for it, other than P&G, who had a name for it, we vastly... criticize advertising agencies of this. We've spent far too little time discussing not just how much do people pay, but how do they pay.
And so, a great example, Rory.
Yeah,
I was going to say, if we look at the electricity system as it is today, essentially everyone pays business class, right? Because it is designed a bit like you talked there about the convenience and the frequency that a business class traveler demands, and therefore pays a top dollar. In the same way, today's electricity system is basically designed that if you don't have to think about when you're going to use this commodity that varies so much in price, you're essentially paying for a business class ticket.
Yeah.
And what we're doing is letting people grab bargains in as many ways as we can. And by the way, at the moment, a lot of the time when we're giving people really cheap electricity at different times, it's a bit like filling empty seats on a plane. You know, as you get close to takeoff, if you've still got empty seats, you'll sell them at any price because flying air is the least profitable thing an airline can do. And in the same way, though, we should have an energy system where whenever we've got spare electrons, we're basically pricing them out at any cost because it's better than throwing them away.
And so storage, which is the whole idea of effectively, you might charge your car to 90% even though you only need a 50% charge. And then effectively your car becomes effectively a sump for available energy at times of high demand. That's a fantastic potential technology. I think it's only a few cars that do it at the moment. Nissan Leaf, I think, does it, doesn't it? The Nissan Leaf can feed back into the grid.
Yeah, there's about four models that we currently can integrate with to do this. We're at the beginning of the electric vehicle revolution. I mean, fewer than 5% of cars today are electric. The rate of growth is high. And as manufacturers get more and more confident with the kind of bi-directional technology, so it will become more and more normal. One interesting thing on this, a thought experiment for me, is look, about two-thirds of UK homes have got a car.
Yeah.
And over time, they'll all become electric. So an electric car holds enough power for a typical house for maybe, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 days. So 65% or thereabouts of UK households will be sitting on a battery that holds enough power for their entire house for 3 or 4 or 5 days, which means if the UK have no power for several days, by the way, it's not going to happen. But actually, we've got this incredible new form of resilience. Now, of course, we can be using it as a backup like that, but we can be using it the way you're describing as a sort of a system that lets us soak up electricity when it's cheap. But the volume of this, I think it's the scale of it, is what no one's got their head around.
In the US, I think, that was a major selling feature for the Ford F-150 Lightning. Now, the Ford F-150 Lightning is an electric pickup truck. It's the version of which is, I think, the best-selling car in the world is actually the Ford F-150 pickup truck. And actually, of course, now, the people who drive pickup trucks aren't always the most environmentally concerned people, but they are slightly doomsday preppers. And the very idea that you can run your house off your truck to a lot of Americans, or if you're off the grid, you can run power tools, was a really, really major selling feature of that vehicle. You know, that's an interesting case because I think it's getting people into environmentalism, not through hair-shirted, hand-wringing concern, but actually by selling positive benefits. There isn't a trade-off here, actually. We're treating it as if it's a massive trade-off. Yeah.
If you're a prepper, you'll have solar panels at home because you're not going to rely on the grid and you're not going to rely on the petrol stations. And so actually, as a prepper with an F-150 and some solar panels, you're simultaneously an eco-warrior and probably a climate change rejector, right?
Yes. Now, yes.
By the way, there's no criticism of any part of this, but the point really being, it speaks to the fact that, look, like so many new technologies, the combination of renewable generation, electric vehicles, by the way, electric heating with heat pumps, it's simply better technology. It's so much cheaper. We just have to use it right.
Now, I've got an interesting one here on heat pumps. Now, Rob's already going crazy because we're going off-piste here. My brother's an astrophysicist, and so he knows all the physics of heat pumps. And he's solving the problem by installing air conditioning at home. Okay? And I said, well, why are you installing air conditioning? He said, because air conditioning is an air-to-air heat pump. You just reverse the thing. And effectively, it works like a fridge in reverse, okay? It takes heat from outside and brings it in. And he said it has all the efficiency gains of one of those things where you have to dig up your lawn, rip out your boiler, etc. And I said, well, do you get a grant for that? And he said, no. I said, well, why don't you get a grant given that it's a heat pump? He said, well, the reason is the government is terrified that people will use air conditioning to air condition their homes, and therefore it will lead to more demands on the grid. And I said, wait. I said, this is the UK, right? I think that's a perfectly reasonable objection if you're living in Greece or Italy or Southern Europe or whatever, or North Africa, okay? We're going to use air conditioning realistically in our homes for about 2 weeks of the year. Now, I said, the point I'm making is that getting people to leave your existing gas boiler in place with your existing radiators, but mostly heating your home through effectively an air-to-air heat pump, I can sell that to thousands of people. With the additional benefit that, particularly if you're elderly, if there's a heat wave, you won't die, you know, or you won't suffer 2 weeks of major discomfort. Okay. Now, the government, for some reason, won't subsidize that because there's because it's easier to sell. Now, that's crazy, right? I mean, I would argue that actually, you know, you could sell that solution to quite a lot of people. Their gas consumption would continue, but would only really kick in at periods of extreme cold. And most of their heating in their homes day to day will be provided effectively with the, what is it, fivefold efficiencies of a heat pump. Okay, it seems perfect. What's your opinion on that? Because I think that's a fundamental government mistake, which is to mandate the perfect in preference over the possible. I don't know. I'd be interested to know your view.
Yeah, no, I mean, and so for those who are not familiar, I mean, look, basically a heat pump is a magical device.
Yeah, it is magical.
It takes 1 kilowatt of electricity and turns it into 3, 4, 5 kilowatts of heat. It doesn't break the laws of physics, by the way.
No.
It achieves this because it's not turning electricity into heat. It's using electricity to grab heat from somewhere in the environment and pump it into your house. That's why it's called a heat pump.
So in other words, moving heat is a more economical process than generating heat. Yeah, got it.
That's right. So, in fact, if you stand next to a heat pump outside a house, it will be sucking air in, grabbing some heat from it, and then pumping the air back out. And you actually feel they pump out cold air into the environment. I mean, it's only a few degrees colder, but they grab those few degrees, and then they multiply it up and pump it into your house. traditionally at 45 degrees, but now, you know, for example, Octus makes heat pumps that work at 75 degrees C, i.e. hotter than a gas boiler. But the heat that they kind of put into the house, they can either put into the house by heating water and then pumping it through your radiators, or heating air and just pumping the air through the house. Because you can run them in reverse, you can pump out cold air instead of hot air, which is how you have that air conditioning benefit. Now, the reality is a lot of UK homes would struggle with the use of the hot air because they don't have a way of circulating the air around inside.
Got it.
But by the way, if homes are built for it, it is an incredible technology because it is literally heating and cooling all in one box. Now, on the government, then, the subsidies. Look, first of all, we should be very glad the government are helping push heat pumps. But there are two or three things that would make a world of difference and where they're kind of fighting their own forces, because a lot of heat pumps, crazily, need planning permission,
yes,
which takes weeks or months. And every council's got different rules, right? And some councils are really good at it. Some councils hate the technology. And so you've got the government want to give you $7,500 to put a heat pump in. And then you've got a council that can make it impossible. And the reason is, allegedly, the noise made by heat pumps. But look, a heat pump is roughly the same amount of noise as a fridge.
Yes.
All right. So we've got fridges inside our kitchens. We seem to be happy enough.
Yeah.
Putting a heat pump on your outside wall. Anyway.
I'm not sitting in my kitchen going, please make the noise stop. No, I don't even notice the damn thing. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely true.
So the second thing is you need to get the government grant, you need to get an energy performance certificate and then carry out recommended measures if required. And so a lot of people, once they start getting the EPC and then you've got to get some insulation, they just give up because it's a hassle.
Yeah.
It's a hassle. Meanwhile, a gas boiler, which emits enormous amounts of carbon, is hugely inefficient. You're allowed to just get one of them and bang it in. So what they've done is they've taken the perfect solution, the air source heat pump, and made it more hassle than the bad solution. And the last thing is, traditionally, heat pumps have worked at these lower temperatures, 45 degrees, versus a gas boiler, which should be at 55.
So originally you needed to replace your radiators, didn't you? I think there was an issue where existing radiators
were insulation, whatever.
Now, at that point, most people are going, okay, too much grief.
Too much, yeah. Which is why we now make high-temperature heat pumps so you can just do a direct replacement. But even then, what you'll find is that the perfect being the enemy of the good, there's quite a lot of I think there are 32 different forms that we need to fill in when we're providing a heat pump under the government schemes. As opposed to a gas boiler, where the bloke bangs it in and then gives you, signs a piece of paper and leaves. So we've got to get to a world where, and I was talking to a government minister about this, because I was talking about the need for an EPC. And they said, well, that's good, isn't it? It's making sure homes are efficient. I said, well, no, it's bad. It's a hassle. I've got to say, instantly they got it.
Yeah.
But we've really got to help. Throughout the civil service are incredible, well-meaning people. But what they wanted, each one of them's tasked with an objective. And they're too far removed from the end customer and the customer experience that, frankly, we, your independent installers, are dealing with all the time.
This is really interesting because there's a great book called... called The Customer Copernicus, which is, and this is where government's particularly bad. This is why I say that if everybody had worked for P&G for 4 years, you wouldn't have half the problems we did. Because one thing a marketing training does is you actually see things from the customer's point of view, not the institutional point of view. And the institutional point of view is a very, very kind of stupid version, really. It's a very, very bad proxy. Institutional efficiency and effectiveness is a very bad proxy for actual persuasion and behavioral change. And so one thing you've done, by the way, which I think is a work of genius, which I happen to find on your website, is the idea of the fan club. Now, it's very small, just to explain, but this is the solution to NIMBYism. Which is if you live within, effectively, within sight.
It's a great example. So look,
beautiful, beautiful example. Explain that to our lovely listeners. The fan club, the Octopus fan club is genius.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I'll give you the history to it as well, because we learned stuff in doing it. And I think it's a really big measure, which is you have to be doing stuff all the time. And then you learn far more than sitting there pontificating and doing PowerPoints or Excel sheets or whatever. So we're aware that we keep saying to people, that renewables are the cheapest source of power and we need to build more of them. And yet the reality in people's experience is we've built all these renewables and in return, all we've got is some extra lines on your bill that are levies to pay for the stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And traditionally, when you want to build renewables, you turn up in a beauty spot and start sticking turbines up. So you're telling people we're going to ruin a beauty spot and we're going to put up your energy bills. All for something that you may or may not believe is going to happen and you fear will be okay. And it's a long time in the future, it's a long time, a long way away. And yet we know that the fundamentals of renewables are they're cheaper. And so what we thought is, why don't we create a product, the Fan Club, where if you live within about a kilometre of one of our turbines, qualifying turbines, we'll give you a discount on your electricity when it's windy. We give you 20% off whenever the blades are turning and 50% if it's at full power in real time. And so it means if you look out the window and you can see the blades turning, you know you're getting cheap power. By the way, it's also live in your app and all this stuff. But the interesting thing when we did this, what we expected, what we wanted to do was demonstrate renewables are cheaper. What we didn't expect was 22,000 communities wrote to us asking for one of these because they want cheap power. And you're right.
It's actually 22,001 because I signed up yesterday for my own postcode. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. And by the way, it may be a lot more by now because I haven't checked the numbers lately. But that, interesting, was not the primary reason we did it. But it was it's the primary benefit, which is discovering this idea that, look, when Asda want to build a supermarket near a village, the village have a conversation. Do we want the cheap products and a big range of stuff convenient from this Asda? Or do we want to avoid, some people might worry about traffic or something? And they have a decision. And some communities decide they want it and some decide they don't. And that's what win should be.
Because if you think about NIMBYism, an awful lot of NIMBYism is driven by dog in the manger. Now, I'm very opposed to NIMBYism and I actually often write to the council in support of planning proposals. If someone wanted to start a 24-hour drum and bass studio next to my flat, I'd probably complain. But I noticed that I wrote and complained when a neighbour wanted to build a house on our drive. And being absolutely honest about it, the reason was that he made £400,000 from building the house. I got nothing except the inconvenience of his building.
Yeah.
Now, if he'd said to me, bluntly speaking, I'll build the house, but once the house is built and sold, I'll give you £10,000. I would have gone, yeah, fine. Got over. But the idea that someone else benefits disproportionately and you get nothing is behind most NIMBYism. Now, I said, look, if you build a new runway at Heathrow, give the people who live in the flight path some benefits, like their own private lounge at Heathrow, or free parking for 2 weeks of the year in short stay, or something, right? Give them something.
Yeah.
And that's a trade-off which we can actually then reframe to our own advantage. But nobody can reframe...
I think Disneyland did that, didn't they? Walt Disney gave the residents of Florida free annual membership when they built Disney World, right? I don't remember the exact details, but what you're describing is precisely this.
Yeah. And so it doesn't actually have to be that major a benefit, but you have to be able to frame it as a quid pro quo, because if it's just a quid pro zilch, no one can actually go, hey, I'm in favor of this, because there isn't a single, all they can basically focus on is the downside, and to be honest, resentment of the other person's gain in many cases.
Yeah,
and so
right.
The fan club is, so if the blades are turning at all, you get 20% off your energy. And when they're actually turning at full capacity, you're getting half price. So you actually look out of the window, go turn the tumble dryer on. Obviously, you look at the app, but you could look out of the window and basically go,
what happens?
Yeah, this is great.
And by the way, then you think, you go like, once you've kind of got used to the idea of cheap electricity from your local wind, especially if you use it at those times. And by the way, here's the thing. Even if you don't change your usage, your power is going to be cheaper because sometimes it's windy. If you change your usage, it's even cheaper. And then if you go like, wow, why don't I get an electric car and fill it up with half price electricity when it's wind? And so all these things compound to bring people the benefits of the system we need to build. Whereas, the kind of traditional policy where everything's just a blancmange, everything's just averaged, you don't get any of that benefit.
That, and I think this does actually come in a sense from the single representative agent model in economics, yeah. which is fundamentally, I mean, you know, if you consider something in economics like interest rates, okay, a rise in interest rates makes some people richer and some people immeasurably poorer, but yet it's assessed as though it were kind of affecting people at the average level, which is a kind of, you know, it's a kind of nonsense. And marketers
let me give you an example.
Go ahead, please. Yeah.
Okay, an example of just how serious this is, right? At the moment, every half hour, National Grid runs an auction among the electricity generators of the UK and to work out which ones it's going to ask to provide the power in that half hour. Whichever is the most expensive winning bid, i.e. the most expensive one that makes it through, sets the price for everyone. So then every generator gets paid. So you could generate at 5 pence a kilowatt hour, but if someone else has been in at 20 and they're part of the mix, you're going to get paid 20. Now, that then sets this price for the whole country.
That's whack. It's seriously whack.
So try this, right?
Okay, so, you're right, yeah.
So that means, by the way, the vast majority of electricity we're paying for is vastly more than the, you know, than we could have auctioned it for in your local area. The consequences of this are huge. It's like wine lakes and butter mountains, but for electrons. So yeah. When it's windy in Scotland, we pay the wind farms to turn off because we can't get all of the excess power into England. So instead of giving people of Scotland cheap power, we're just throwing it away. Now, if we gave them cheap power, of course that would be beneficial to the people of Scotland.
Who decided this? Because this is like a Dutch auction in reverse. It is the opposite of Price Drop TV, if you're familiar with Price Drop TV.
Yeah.
Where everybody pays the lowest market clearing price.
Yeah. So, well, to be fair, they would say this is the lowest clearing price on a national level. The problem is, like, because the UK's got 14 different, I don't know, regions or something for price, right? If we did that auction on a regional basis, 13 regions would be cheaper. So, as it happens, because we do this every half hour, sometimes, right, it's not the same region's always most expensive. So, every region would be cheaper if we ran this auction on a regional basis. But more than that, take that Scottish example, right? At the same time as we're throwing away green electricity in Scotland, there's a 10-year moratorium on building data centres to the west of London. Slough has got the greatest concentration of data centres in Europe, and you can't build any more for a decade. Now, those data centres, if they could get cheap, sometimes free power in Scotland, and it's green because of the wind, they'd all be moving to Scotland instead of not being able to build or building in another country. And so what we find, Scotland, by the way, would have the cheapest electricity in Europe if we didn't have a single national price. Northern England would be among the cheapest. Wales would be very cheap.
Yeah.
In fact, every region would be cheaper. And so really understanding that in a world of renewables where, you know, you're getting different amounts of generation at different times in different locations, we need the price signals that people can use it.
Of course.
And this isn't just about households. It's about electric vehicles and heat pumps, all doing it automatically, like you're realizing, and industries. And industries locating there, just like the steelworks located where there was iron ore and coal. So data centers should be moving where there's renewables. But we don't have any, there's no price signals for this at all.
There's an interesting argument, isn't there, about Bitcoin miners, which is some people argue that it's beneficial because they're the customer of last resort, which is, if you make the energy cheap enough, they will always use it. So they are a kind of weird base, a kind of floor level demand, which might actually be beneficial. So that always strikes me as one of those interesting kind of economic conundrums. But that is absolutely fascinating. That is really absolutely intriguing.
It's better to use electricity for something than it is to throw it away. So here's an interesting thing we do, Rory. Quite frequently, when it's very windy, the grid price actually goes negative. All right? And traditionally, National Grid, the price went negative, and then big industrial users would dump the heat into some industrial process. We've got some tariffs where we give consumers the benefit of those negative prices. And what we find behaviorally, here's a great thing. I see tweets that say, my car battery is full, so I'm going to take it off the driveway. You can come around and charge. You'll get free power. I'll get paid, right? And it's all carbon-free because it's coming from excess wind.
That's astounding. So you're incentivizing storage, effectively, rather than letting the electricity go to waste or turning off the turbines. You actually incentivizing people to arrive at their own storage solutions. This is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. This is absolutely, I must admit, I never thought of that. That's absolutely brilliant. My car's currently full, but please come round.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Top two challenges, brought to you by ALF Insight.
ALF Insight helps media owners, agencies and marketing service providers improve their new business pipelines by equipping them with in-depth insights, accurate information and daily news updates on the leading and challenger brands in the UK. ALF also helps sports clubs, venues and charities win new partnership deals. ALF Insight identifies the brands to target at the right time, providing everything you need to tailor the perfect pitch. Visit ALF Insight, that's ALFinsight.com, or click the link in the episode description to find out more.
So, since the breakdown of relations with Russia, various wars, shifting in geopolitical landscapes, cost of living crisis, what do you see, two questions in a sense, what do you see the biggest challenge being for Octopus over the next few years, and what do you see as the biggest challenge for the energy sector as a whole?
Look, first of all, the energy crisis was of a magnitude I think most people haven't got their head around.
No.
At one point, like currently, the new price cap is £1,700 for a typical household. At one point in the crisis, it would have been £7,000 if the government hadn't stepped in and paid, I know, three quarters of our bills. The cost of wholesale gas went up 15-fold, 15x. So, you know, when we hear about inflation being 10%, gas inflation at one point was, 1,500%. Now, fortunately, it's dropped back a lot because the world has been rewiring to reduce our dependence on Russian gas and to ship gas in you know, from the US and from Qatar and so on.
And fracking, secondly, in the US has made, of course, the US is now an energy exporter, isn't it, which is interesting.
It is. Although, by the way, try this. Texas, the land of oil and gas, 72% of their electricity is from renewables. It's the highest in the US, right? Because they've got abundant wind, they've got quite a lot of sun, and they've got a place, and they don't have many planning restrictions. You can build stuff there.
Right? I know, yeah.
But so the interesting thing is, but back on the challenge. So for Octopus, the biggest challenge for us was how do we look after customers when their bills have doubled and trebled overnight?
Yeah.
We had a choice, actually. I remember very clearly the choice going into the crisis was, do we batten? The first instinct you have is to batten down the hatches and, you know, wait till the storm has passed. But we decided that the right thing to do was to help our customers, and that meant to lean into it. And so, for example, I did quite a lot of media to talk to customers about what was going on. And I thought it was important they understood that this was a yet another consequence of our dependence on fossil fuels, because basically, fossil fuel, gas as a commodity is one that only some countries have and only some companies have access to. And when it's in short supply, they've essentially, yes, deliberately or not, they've got you by the short and curlers. You have no choice. As soon as you move to a renewable world, a world of electrification, you've got a lot more independence and resilience. But also to talk to customers about what we could do about it. And, you know, for example, the fact that if you turn your thermostat down 1 degree, it saves 7 to 10% on your gas bill, just 1 degree. By the way, I talked about that with Martin Lewis, who brilliantly talked it to his audience. And I think, you know, in a world where you can't change the fact that the commodity costs so much, again, you can think about how do you use it differently.
Yes.
But the thing I was most proud of, frankly, was one night I was on the way home. It was about 10 p.m. It was bitterly cold. And I pictured sort of an elderly person living on their own, probably not very mobile, too scared to switch their heating on. And it was so cold, Rory. And I thought, like, I wish I could tell them it's okay. But I can't, because I know how expensive this is and I know how hard up they are. And I remembered a conversation with a PhD engineer, a guy who works a lot on heat pumps with us. And he'd said, it only takes, I don't know, 40 watts, maybe 60 watts to heat a human. But a gas boiler, for example, is 10,000 watts. And I was thinking, how can we get 50 or 60 watts into someone? And suddenly realized that electric blankets, that's exactly what they do. And I phoned up our chief marketing product officer, who, by the way, joined Ogilvy as a result of one of an ad you wrote. But anyway, many years ago.
Fantastic.
But I phoned her up. I phoned her up at about, 10:30 at night. And I said to her, can we get hold of 5,000 electric blankets? And whenever someone phones us and they're in this situation where they're immobile, they're infirm, you know, illnesses like cancer make it very hard for some people to hold their temperature, just send them an electric blanket. By the way, we've got to keep this under the radar because I don't want media stories going, energy boss says you can't heat your home.
Now, this is actually a problem, actually, which is that good advice to people who are cash constrained is in danger from an energy company and coming across as kind of, for example, you only need to heat a room. You don't need to heat the whole house is one thing.
Totally.
But you only need to heat your body. You don't need to heat the room at some extreme level. But it's very difficult about, right? Saying that. It's very difficult saying that without looking either sort of dough on bar or, you know, or looking kind of completely unreasonable. And that's a really, really interesting question. Yeah. How you communicate that. And you chose not to communicate it. Lovely.
We just sent them. By the way, they cost us, I don't know, 18 quid, 22 quid wholesale. But we started sending them out. And it's 2 or 3 months down the line that one of the customers posted on social media, gratefully, saying how grateful she was for this bag. And the son spotted it. But because we'd got thousands of customers who by now had experienced it and loved it, it's an incredibly positive story about how a seat bag can make a difference. And by then, we had the data that showed that people were saving 300 quid on their annual gas bill because they were heating themselves, like they were snuggling up on the sofa with a sleeping bag rather than trying to get a room to 22 degrees.
Yeah.
Now, in the end, I think we sent out 50,000. But the issue is, like, they cost like 20 quid and they save 300. It's a 15x payback for the consumer. Martin Lewis then wrote about it and the UK ran out of sleeping bags. And that was a great response to that challenge of what do you do when you can't afford gas?
That's really, because one of the interesting things is that one of the things I notice and, you know, is that people are actually worrying the ignorant about what, I mean, I know someone who's, you know, they've got a degree, they're highly intelligent people, but they were annoyed because someone came to their house and without asking permission, charged their mobile phone overnight next to the bedstand. Okay, which I guess is what, 0.1p or 1p.
I mean, it won't show up in your monthly P&L.
And I suddenly realized that people don't realize what's expensive in their home and what they worry about televisions and lights, for example. They get paranoid about leaving a light on, and yet they'll leave an electric heater on. And then you also get the behavior, which my own kids, who are fairly bright, but if they come home and the house is cold, they turn the thermostat up to 25. And I go, we can't even get the house to 25 in cold weather. It doesn't get hotter faster by setting a ludicrous target. But I mean, literally, people, you know, ovens are actually quite expensive. Air fryers are actually quite a good cost-saving device and so on.
Early on, Rory,
nobody has a clue about this stuff. Yeah. I suddenly realize schools are failing here totally.
Here's a couple of things. I think, again, back to the energy crisis. We ran a program in the first run of the energy crisis, which we called Winter Workout. And we basically gave people the opportunity to set a target. Do you want to say 5%, 10%, or 15% on your gas bill? And then every week, weather adjusted, we gave them, by the way, for their weather, for the weather of their house, we gave them an update on how they were doing. What was really interesting was we chose the top 9 things that are easy to do, that almost anyone can do, that would save you gas. We then got people to give us feedback, which ones they were doing, which ones worked, and then to give us their own tips. By the end of the program, over 300,000 people have participated. We also, by the way, got about 300,000 tips in from customers on what they had done to save money. By the way, it's not that each customer gave one. Some gave 100, some gave none, obviously, because it's not average. At the end of that program, what we'd done was really built up this huge data bank of what people find easy and helpful. Back to that point, and understanding what made a difference. Now, at the beginning, you talked about shifting your tumble dryer, I think, as kind of you were trying to persuade energy companies people should shift their tumble dryer. And I was going to say, yeah, a tumble dryer uses about 100 times more power per cycle than an hour of TV, right?
Yeah.
So you don't have to turn your lights off. And I mean, of course, it's good to turn them off. It's not going to touch the edges. Shifting a tumble dryer or an oven by an hour or two dramatically drops the UK's peak demand, which is why we've got another program we run, Saving Sessions, where we've got 1.4 million households signed up to this. And we send them a message either 3 hours or 24 hours before a time of peak grid demand. And we'll pay them, I don't know, 50p a pound, £2 to shift consumption out of that, just out of that 1 hour. Now, what's really interesting, first of all, people love it because they've got agency and the chance to save money.
Yeah.
They can save enough money.
And people love gaming people love gaming the system. I mean, it's just, right, you know.
And try this. Yeah. So, and you discover what the substitutes are. The substitute for having, you know, for electricity is not sitting in the dark. For most people, it's cooking an hour later or using a microwave or an air fryer and not using a high, you know, a high consumption appliance like a dishwasher or whatever, which you might normally do at tea time, but by doing it an hour or two later, you're sorted. But some of them also take the dog for a walk. Some sit and play family games instead of sitting around watching TV and stuff. And others go to the pub, right? And we get all these great stories about the way that as soon as they understand the financials, they behave differently in ways that make them happy.
That's absolutely enchanting because actually, in some ways, of course, the cost of living crisis wasn't quite as severe as people thought because people practice substitution. So, for example, frozen vegetables, I don't think, went up in price at all. Other food items went up a hell of a lot. And people can substitute one form of calorie for another. And time substitution is often, to be honest, I mean, you can actually make it enjoyable, I mean, in some ways. You know, that this assumption that my friend, the economist Nicholas Gruen, always says that one of the curses of economics is it foisted this idea that there's always a trade-off and that you've got to look for the trade-off. And he said, well, there are lots of ingenious solutions which are fully positive sum, which economists aren't looking for because they start by assuming there's a trade-off. And actually shifting your consumption. And there's one tip I will give, by the way, which is don't ever tell people to put their tumble dryers on overnight because you'll have the fire service going bonkers because you shouldn't really use a tumble dryer when you're asleep or when you're out of the house. Apparently, they are a bit of a, you know, they're the hair straighteners of the kitchen appliance world. So but on the other hand, you can put your tumble dryer on, assuming you don't get to bed at 9 o'clock. You can put your tumble dryer on at 10 in the evening. Not a problem at all. And
so that's what we talk about, shifting an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. Currently in the UK, shifting out of peak makes a huge difference. By the way, for something like an electric car, which you can happily charge at night, you can get bonkers cheap charging even without the bi-directional stuff. We've got 130,000 electric cars where we set their charging schedule every day by interfacing with the car or the charger. And those drivers pay, by the way, no one knows what these things mean, but I'll put it in perspective. They pay about 7.5p a kilowatt hour, which is 3 or 4 times less than the normal grid price because they're letting us grab it at the cheapest time. And by the way, we also get paid a bit by National Grid for helping balance the system and things like that, all of which goes to keeping the price down for drivers. That sort of, you don't even have to think about it stuff. In that case, there's a gigawatt of cars we do that with. Now no one knows what a gigawatt is, but a year ago it was 100 megawatts. It's grown 10x in a year. And it's about the same size as a nuclear power station. And so when the UK is falling over itself how to build a nuclear power station, the fleet of electric vehicles we're building, you know, if we can do, if Octopus alone can do one nuclear power station-ish in a year when only 5% of cars are electric, where's this going to go?
You've also done, by the way, a fantastic thing as an electric trial driver myself, which is you've created this product, Electroverse, which is a charging card, which more or less, I mean, as you sign up more and more partners, more or less solves that pain of payment business at... I mean, one bit of advice to anybody who's thinking of buying an electric car. Greg may not want to hear this. Actually spend the first month without home charging. And the reason for that is that you will then get to know how to use those remote chargers when you're on the road. Because the problem happens, if you have home charging when you first get your car, the first time you have to learn how to use a charger at a motorway service station, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, it's raining, and a serial killer's escaped from the nearby jail. It's the wrong moment to have to learn how to do that. So that's one little electric car driver tip. And you've created this thing, Electroverse, which I have, which is a fantastic kind of payment network for a whole range of different high speed and I assume green. Are you the providers of those networks in part? You must be, I suppose. Are you?
Yeah. So look, for those who don't know, electric vehicle chargers out of home are run by different companies, and most of those companies you have a different payment card or different membership, whatever. And so, when you're out driving and you turn up at a charging station you've never used before, you have to download an app or try and sign up to a site. It's very painful. What Electroverse does is we integrate with 572 different networks. We get every bit of data, by the way, on the pricing and availability of every one of those charging stations. So in the app, you can find the closest, the cheapest, the fastest. But you can also pay about 75% of them in the UK. By the way, more than that in Europe, on your Octopus account, just directly on the Octopus app, or with a card we'll send you. The interesting thing from this, by the way, again, we set it up to be convenient to drivers, so they didn't have to join all the different networks. You just join one. But as a result, first of all, we were able to when you asked a question about supplying. We supply about 40% of them with electricity. And now, that means we know when the electricity is cheap, what times of day, and when it's expensive. And we've increasingly worked to provide a sort of retail overlay. So we give discounts if people are on some of them when people are using electricity off-peak. Not only does that mean that they're getting cheaper charging and you're beneficial to the energy system because you're using electrons when they're abundant, not when they're tight, but also for the charge point owner, the people who own the infrastructure, they're getting a better return on capital.
Of course.
Because the assets are getting better utilization. And then on top of that, we're getting all this incredible data on price elasticity. We were able to improve the use of one network by 40% through these time of use stuff. And then, Rory, again, one of the bits of magic when you're innovating is we discover, of course, one of the problems with EV charging is you might turn up at a charging point and find it's full. Well, yeah. We've got the data that shows for every one of these charge points how heavily utilized it is and what times of day. So we can then tell you which ones are likely to be free. In fact, we can tell you whether they're free right now, but yes, if you've got to drive there in half an hour, we'll let you know whether it's likely to be free in half an hour. And we'll tell you whether it's likely to be functional or whether it's one of the ones that are not reliable. The interesting thing is just as soon as you're doing this, the benefits compound, and it makes it easier and easier to move to electric vehicles. It makes it easier to make electricity green, and it brings the whole cost of the system down.
Because I was amazed by that because you send out an RFID card. I'd had this problem where you literally have to have about 17 different apps, and you solved that problem. So that seems part of you seem unusual for a utility in being so heavily customer focused. In other words, you effectively solve people's problems in a useful way that they're appreciative of, and that seems to be you seem to be genuinely customer focused, and this is recognised in those various Which awards, which is recommended supplier 7 years in a row. How does your approach to customer service differ? First of all, obviously you're presumably less penny pinching than most organisations are, which regard that stuff purely as a cost to be minimised. But what is it that fundamentally differentiates you there?
Yeah. So first of all, the founding team, before I worked at Procter & Gamble, I was actually a video games developer. And after I left Procter & Gamble.
Which company was it? Where were you a video games developer? Not Psygnosis, was it?
No, it wasn't. I originally did some work for a company called Source. They were a contract programmer for a company called Ocean. And then I was freelance. By the way, the first game I did as a freelancer didn't get published because it was great programming, but wasn't fun to play. And I learned a lot about the importance of delivering for customers, right? If it doesn't matter what you do, if it doesn't meet the customer need, it's a failure. Anyway, but, so I think after Procter & Gamble, I set up a technology business. And when we sold that, we had the opportunity to do something else. And we were very good at building enterprise software. And so we recognized that the energy sector is one in which, one of the key reasons energy companies traditionally provide a bad service is they sit on terrible systems. If you phone them up, the poor person at the other end, often great people, by the way, is often trying to get work between five different platforms and they can't help you. So they've got to hand you on to another department and maybe they'll put you through and you have to go through it all again. Or worse than that, they promise they'll call you back and they don't know all that stuff. So, by the way, it also makes them expensive because all of that is expensive overhead that's making customers miserable rather than happy. And it can't cope with all the big data stuff that you need to do, the innovation we've talked today. So we built a technology platform, we call it Kraken, to run energy companies. By the way, we now license it. We run it ourselves, but we license it to 54 million other accounts. And by the way, people like Severn Trent Water as well are now going to be using it.
So that's software as a service, effectively, is it? It is literally...
Yeah, it's basically a SaaS platform. It's
a SaaS platform.
Shopify, where you... Basically, Shopify is a sort of SaaS that lets you run an e-commerce business. It's a bit like a very large version of Shopify, but for utility. So you just move your customers and your staff over, and you've got everything you need to run an energy company, but just dramatically more efficiently. Now, there's a couple bits on top of that, though. I've got to give huge kudos to our first investor, because our pitch to the investors was, through technology, we're going to be vastly more efficient, all this stuff. And he said, but make sure you love your customers. It's the one thing he gave us. And we took that to heart. And so a couple of things we do that are unusual. Our customers are managed, we don't have a call center stuff. Instead, we have operations teams. Each team is about 10 or 11 people, and they look after 60 or 70,000 customers. It's their customer base, and they have total ownership for it. So the stuff that traditionally got these disposition, the call center, the front office, the back office, all that stuff, they just do it all. So if you phone up,
So they own the group of 10. Do you know an interesting thing, which is that Toby, I met the chief operating officer of Shopify, they do the same thing. Now, obviously, their customer-facing staff are actually retailer-facing staff. And he modeled this on the idea that sports teams are almost always somewhere between 8 and 15 people. And he got a whole load of grief about this because they said, well, surely you need greater kind of scale economies and so forth. Yeah. And he said, no. We have a group of – there's a team leader, and then there are basically 10 people whose job is to look after this particular business.
Yeah.
And he said, that's how humans work.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to try to scale it up by having some vast, great sort of cube farm with 200 people and, a kind of David Brent tyrant at the top. So this is really interesting.
That's exactly that.
Fascinating.
It's exactly that. And if you come into our offices – because largely we're office-based. But the if you come in, you'll see there's a desk, a group of desks – and it'd be 10-ish people, and there'll be a team leader, exactly as you described. And the interesting thing, first of all, is sometimes people say to me, but doesn't that mean like some customers get better service and others get worse? I'm like, well, it does, but on average, it will all be better than anywhere else.
Yes.
And the teams are relentlessly learning from each other. And by the way, they cooperate, they compete. All the data is transparent, so every team can see every other team's data. And so if one team's having great results week after week, by the way, they're only measured on two things. They're measured on customer happiness and they're measured on the number of customers they can look after. So a highly productive team has got great customer happiness, can soak up more customers. As it grows, we'll split it into two teams, creating a new team leader. So effective teams breed... kind of more.
This is Darwinian. It's absolutely Darwinian customer service, isn't it? This is fantastic.
Because by the way, when teams aren't performing, and look, there can be a whole pile of reasons for it. Sometimes a new team leader hasn't really gelled with the team. Sometimes, not really capable of the job we've asked them. Sometimes they just need a fresh start. And we'll break the teams up, and so teams that are not working, sooner or later, we help them, but if it's not working, We can dissolve those teams back into other teams. So that Darwinian stuff works for both, enabling the best to really grow, enabling us to identify the ones where it's not working and work through that.
This is really interesting because Amazon also only measures their customer support staff on customer happiness. And it's very weird because if you think about it, the whole purpose of this group is to maintain customer happiness for as many people to as great an extent as possible. And yet typically the metrics that are imposed are kind of efficiency metrics, like how brief you can make a phone call. Which is effectively
none of that.
It's
right?
Absolute nonsense because you're paying for these people. And by the way, you probably don't want this to go public. I've always argued that really good customer service people should be able to earn large five figure sums. The upper end of five figure sums because that's how valuable they are. But unfortunately, unlike salespeople, it's harder for them to quantify their value. Because retention value is slower to emerge than sales value. And actually, it should be seen as an absolutely serious career where you can go right to the top. But that business where you have these people whose purpose is to make customers happy, and then effectively you measure them on how quickly they can close down a phone call, strikes me as borderline insanity, really. It's completely crazy.
And you know what? The problem with those things is whenever you put in those proxy measures...
Yeah.
You find unintended consequences. So you put in more proxy measures. And before you know it, your team are working through a thicket of impossible targets. It's unbelievably stressful for them. It's terrible outcomes for customers. For example, we all know this thing about when the NHS introduced the four-hour limit in A&E. Some hospitals would meet it by leaving patients in ambulances. And you see the same with, if we target people on how quickly they answer the phone, they'll answer the phone, they then give terrible service or put you on hold, rather than I'd much rather find that sometimes the phone's ringing a long time, but when you get answered, you get properly looked after. And when we look at the metrics, you can see, answer times are getting long. That's our real issue. We know what the real issue is.
Well, I'll give you a tip here, which is funny. In Israel, it's actually a legal requirement. Amazon has a call me button on the website.
Yeah.
Now, what's strange is, nobody else has copied this. Now, it's obvious that Amazon tests everything it does and it knows what it's doing and they're the sharpest tool in the box. And yet they're the only company which has this call me button.
Well, I love that button and I've used it in Amazon. But an interesting feature about our company is this devolving of decision-making. One of the things about having those teams is we need to enable them to make decisions. And the more we try and top-down manage them, the less they take responsibility for the outcome. And the same goes internally how we manage. So our global operations director, who invented that model, by the way, for us, and has made it work brilliantly, he doesn't like the call me button. And I just trust him because I devolve responsibility. And it's an interesting thing internally in how we manage stuff, which is ultimately, I would rather people, at the end of the day, our customer operations, our customer service is genuinely great. And understanding that internally, he has a bunch of views about the unintended consequences of that, and therefore we haven't done it. But I love, by the way, one thing I love servicing is internal debates. And as a company, I think it's really grown up to be able to say, look, I'm really proud of what we do, and these are areas we debate.
But also, employee satisfaction is driven by the extent to which power is devolved and in which people still have autonomy. And one of the worst things that's happening in the workplace is the technologically enabled bureaucratization of decision making, so that everything is basically reduced to an algorithm or a procedure, which then takes away the whole reward of working, which is you get to use discretionary judgment from time to time. And in customer service, that's particularly...
Exactly.
You end up with absurdities where I know what you're saying is right. I know this is a nonsense, but there's nothing I can do, which is the most frustrating thing you can have.
An interesting thing is, some companies, there are observers of our company that think we're just great marketers, right? Now, I think, by the way, from the degree to which we've talked about innovation, it's clear that, we are relentlessly innovating products that customers love and that help bring down the cost of energy whilst going green. But an interesting thing is, harking back to Procter & Gamble, something I learned that was drummed into me at Procter & Gamble was Procter & Gamble relentlessly said, if you want to say something great about your product, you've got to make a great product. And the job of marketers was to truly understand your customer needs, create a product that delivers them, and then tell people about it. And so with us, this thing about customer service, it's not a wrapper on any old company. It's a relentless focus on how do we deliver the best service and then tell people about it. And so if you see our ads about the currently about the Which Awards, or hear the ones on the radio, by the way, which they're snippets of real conversations, right?
I know them. I like them enormously. They're fantastic.
And what we wanted to do was surface this product, because normally service is hidden.
Yeah.
And I think one of the challenges in the service industry is, you know, look, if I go into a retailer, I can instantly see the quality of the product, the range, all that stuff. And it's how do we create the same degree of transparency in a service sector? And what you're really seeing is that.
That's absolutely fantastic. I mean, I think it's because it's so interesting, because, of course, in P&G, the brand manager has P&L responsibility.
That's right.
And so there isn't this sort of ludicrous divide where marketing is there to provide a kind of veneer. You're actually responsible for the whole thing. And it, what's so weird is how few other organizations copy that, despite the fact that it's been proven to be really, really successful. I've got to ask you a question, because I know Rob's probably going crazy about the time. But I've got to ask you a question just about your international expansion. So you've got German particularly. I think you've got 900,000 customers now outside the UK. Is European and indeed global expansion to the UK, is that part of the plan? Because I imagine the fact that you have this Kraken platform makes it comparatively easier to do.
Totally. So a couple of interesting things. And first, by the way, is a challenge of being such a rapidly growing business is even the best briefed of interviewers are always going to be slightly out of date. So we're now over 1 million customers outside the UK.
Sorry.
No, I'm joking. Sorry. I never know whether to say anything, but it's just fun. Anyway, but the second thing, right, is, and look, our business outside the UK is particularly big in France, Italy, Germany, Spain, and Japan. And an interesting feature is that, first of all, we designed our brand, our proposition, to appeal to the fundamentals of all people. A bit like, you know, some of the great global brands that came out of America, they didn't adapt to different countries.
No.
They work because they've got the confidence to say what we've got is what people want, regardless of national context. The second thing is, a bit like with Uber, even though we operate in regulated markets that vary a lot around the world, the product is one that regulators is broadly aligned with what regulators and governments want. And so we're able to, basically, if you open Octopus Energy in Japan, it looks just like it does here.
It helps that the Japanese love sea creatures, don't they? But you've got an innate advantage there. Yeah. But no, so it looks exactly the same. And this is fascinating, because Japan is not, that's not a market. That's not a market which people would traditionally go to early, is it? It's generally regarded as impenetrable. And yet you chose to.
No.
Very
it's
interesting.
It's the world's largest competitive energy market. Ironically, here in UK and Europe, the lands of social welfare, we've got a competitive energy system where you can choose your energy provider. But in America, the land of the free, they have this form of communism everywhere except Texas, where you know, essentially the local authority or some version thereof decides who your energy provider will be. And it really does mean that companies like ours, with all this innovation, actually, we're not able to bring the benefits to Americans the way I'd love to. I mean, we'll get there, but we can't do it the way that we've done it elsewhere. Whereas Japan has got a liberal energy market, and so we could do it there.
That's absolutely fascinating. This is extraordinary. So you might enter the Texan market, but the US will have to wait for effectively liberalization. Do you think that'll be... There are too many vested interests. It's a little like healthcare, I guess. There are just too many vested interests.
We'll have to do it in a different way.
Really interesting.
Exactly. We'll do it in a different way. But interesting, we are in Texas, yeah. So
that's fascinating. Well, thank you so much. This has been an absolute absolute feast of riches in terms of what I've learned, and also what I've learned about. I also feel slightly vindicated, because I was completely baffled 10, 15 years ago why there was no effort put towards effectively just getting people to shift the time of their activities, which seemed to be the easy win. And also your solution to the NIMBY problem with the fan club is glorious. Well, Greg, thank you so much once again. It's been an absolute pleasure. You've been listening to On Brand with Alf and Rory Sutherland. And if you want to do business with Octopus Energy or any other energy brands, contact the Alf Insight team on their website, which is www.alfinsight.com. You can also find the link in the episode description beneath. The series is produced and expertly edited by Ultimate Content. And to make sure you receive the next episode and to tweak the algorithm, do subscribe. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, please do give us a like. Thanks for listening. And here's till next time. Greg, once again, thank you very much indeed.
Ossie, thank you.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.